Well, happy holiday to all of you. We are happy to be here with you on this very special feast day. And I'm glad that we can say happy holy day, happy feast day to one another. Because although we're fasting today, it still is a day of quiet joy, really, because of what this day pictures. It's not a day of sadness, it's a day of joy because we know what's going to happen when this Day of Atonement is fulfilled in the future. But that can be kind of confusing when talking to little ones, especially in our household, about what this day means and telling them, yeah, it's a feast day and we're not going to eat or drink anything for 24 hours. Huh? I think they panicked a little bit this morning and thought we were going to make them go for the full 24 hours today, but we're taking the advice and wisdom from some others who've gone before us and have said, we just let our kids decide when they were ready to try it, but we told them you're not allowed to go backwards. Once you fast for the full 24 hours, you can't then the next year say, no, I don't really want to do it this year, I don't think I can make it. Well, you made it, so we'll start them out with a partial fast and teach them along the way that way. But teaching our children sometimes can help drive home lessons for ourselves as well. Lately, our oldest Sophia has wanted me to stay in her room after bedtime. After we go through the whole good night routine, she asks, will you just sit and lay with me for a while so we can talk? And one of the things we've been doing lately is she'll ask me, can we play true or false? So usually that involves some silly true or false questions that we ask each other. But it always also involves some true or false questions about the Bible lesson for that day. Since we are homeschooling, it's nice that we can build that into the curriculum, and Emily does an excellent job of setting aside a special lesson for them each morning. So in the evenings lately, Sophia will tell me what they talked about, and I come up with some true or false questions for her. So I thought we'd start the sermon today following that routine. A little game of true or false. As a review about some of the basics of this holy day that we're keeping today. So true or false? The Day of Atonement falls on the ninth day of the seventh month. False. It's the tenth day of the seventh month. True or false? The Day of Atonement was the only day of the year when the high priest could enter the Holy of Holies. True. True or false? Satan's favorite holy day is the Day of Atonement because it's all about him. Well, false. I have a feeling that this is his least favorite holy day, and it's not just about him, as we'll talk about later. One more, last one. True or false? Satan is not a living being, but only a symbol of evil. Satan is not a living being, but only a symbol of evil. Well, that question was asked to a group of people, a group of Americans, almost 2,000 of them, in a Barna survey done in 2009. You've probably heard of the Barna group. They do lots of polls and surveys to get an idea of what people actually believe about sometimes things related to religion, other times just worldview. They do lots of surveys. And they take a sampling of individuals from around the country when they do that. So this particular survey, conducted in 2009, was a sampling of 1,871 people who were asked to what degree they agreed with this statement, if it was true or false, that Satan is not a living being, but only a symbol of evil. 59% of Americans that were surveyed agreed with this statement, that Satan is not a living being, but only a symbol. 59%. Of course, that's 59% of those polled. That's how any survey works. It's just a sampling. But it gives you an idea of what people are thinking. 40% strongly agreed with the statement. Strongly agreed that he's not literal. He's only a symbol of evil. And 19% somewhat agreed. And in contrast, only 35% of Americans surveyed believed that Satan is a real being. 26% strongly disagreed with this statement, that Satan is merely symbolic. 9% somewhat disagreed. And if you're a math person, you're probably trying to figure out where the last bit of percentage went. And those were the people that just said they were unsure what to believe about the existence of Satan. Now, these numbers may be alarming, they might be surprising to you, maybe not. But what makes them even more surprising to me when I came across these statistics is that the 1,800 people surveyed were not just a sampling of Americans, they were a sampling of Americans who self-identify as Christians. These were all people that, as part of the survey, described themselves as Christians. And yet, only 35% of them disagreed with this false statement. Only 35% of them actually believe that Satan is a literal being. And these are individuals who identify themselves as Christians. Let's turn to 1 Peter chapter 5. 1 Peter chapter 5, we're going to read just verse 8. Actually, we'll go ahead and read verse 9 too. But 1 Peter 5, we'll begin in verse 8. Where Peter tells the brethren, tells us as well, in verse 8, be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Resist him, steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood in the world. So Satan is described as the adversary, the devil, who walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour, looking for people who he might be able to pick off from the pack. What would happen if only 35% of antelope believed that lions were real? Imagine that headline. Headline, only 35% of antelope believed the lion rumors. Well, the non-believers would be pretty easy prey, wouldn't they? They'd be the ones that didn't try to move, didn't try to run away when others were warning them. The predator is coming. He's looking for you. He's lurking about. I think I see the grass moving over there. These doubters would ignore that, and they'd be easy targets. And you know, the same is true when it comes to knowing that Satan is a literal being who is out to try to destroy. You know, Satan wants nothing more than for us to forget about him and his influence. If we don't believe that the predator is lurking about, then we make for easy prey. And this day, the Day of Atonement, in large part, is all about identifying the enemy. It's about identifying the culprit, the instigator of sin. The Day of Atonement is the day when the enemy of all mankind will finally be identified. So turn back to Revelation chapter 20. We read this here. We know these scriptures, but of course, there's always more we can learn and glean and be reminded of so that these truths don't fade in our mind, so we don't start to question these things. Revelation chapter 20, beginning in verse 1, we read about the future that is to come for this being. It says in verse 1, "Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. He laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. And he cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up, and set a seal on him so that he should deceive the nations no more till 1,000 years were finished. But after these things, he must be released for a little while." When Satan is bound, those who live through the tribulation and into the millennial reign of Jesus Christ will know about this. I don't think this is going to be an event that's hidden under a rock. It better not be. We're the ones that are going to be helping teach people, right? Certainly we're going to be telling them about what's taking place. Look, you've been struggling against sin. You've been struggling to live the right way that you're just finally starting to get to learn about. But there was this being who was working against you the entire time. We're going to be telling people about that. We're going to be pointing out the fact that they had someone they were battling against and they didn't even know it. People will know who the enemy is. They'll experience life without his influence. And then they'll be able to really feel the difference. They'll be able to experience the difference of life with Satan's influence and life with a mind open to God's truth and without that negative influence pulling against them. And I think it'll be an obvious contrast for those who were alive before the return of Christ and who remain alive in the millennium and experience life without the enemy. But of course, we have the incredible blessing of knowing these things now, brethren. We don't have to wait until the return of Jesus Christ, until Satan is bound, to understand that we do have an enemy who's battling against us. God tells us that clearly in His Word. We have an advantage in that sense because we know we're in a fight. Satan's constant influence and bombardment of negativity and sin and anger and discouragement are so normal to mankind. Just imagine what it's going to be like when suddenly Satan's broadcast is quieted. It's turned off. Right now, people live among the noise of his influence without even realizing it. But we have this incredible blessing of having our minds open now to this truth of who Satan is and what he does. So let's review some scriptures today about those things. Who is this enemy? Who is this being? And how does he work? How does he fight against us? How does he lurk about, seeking whom he may devour? If you turn over with me to Ephesians chapter 2, we're going to read a handful of verses today about Satan the devil that are probably familiar to all of us, but I think it's important, especially on this day, to review these things and to remember that we are in a battle. Ephesians chapter 2, we'll begin reading in verse 1, and I'll try to stop reaching for the bottle of water over here, that imaginary one. Ephesians chapter 2, beginning in verse 1. And you he made alive, who were dead in trespasses and sins, in which you once walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit who now works in the sons of disobedience, among whom also we all once conducted ourselves in the lust of our flesh, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, just as the others. Satan is described here as the prince of the power of the air. You know, this has been likened in the past to a broadcast. You can't see sound waves going through the air. It's pretty incredible to stop and think about how some of the inventions of man have come about, how people have figured these things out. How does a radio station broadcast a conversation, and then you can hear it in your car while you're driving down the road? So those of you who are more technologically minded, maybe it makes sense, but to me, I don't know. I just push the power button and I enjoy it, and maybe one day I'll get how it all works. But Satan works in that way as well. This invisible force, this broadcast going out, and we can't just turn the button off. It's constantly there, working against us, whether we realize it or not. And he's good at what he does. He doesn't always just openly try to convince us or other people in the world to choose evil. He doesn't make it that clear. He tries to get people to think that evil is good. He knows how to market evil in an effective way. He knows how to market evil to sound like it's a good option. He knows how to appeal to the heart and the flesh. He knows how to get mankind to want to buy what he's selling. Now, he's an influencer, if there ever was one. If we turn over to chapter 6, we have this description of this battle that we're facing against this being, this prince of the power of the air. If we begin in verse 11 of Ephesians 6, put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. Wiles simply means craftiness or deceit, trickery. He doesn't play fair. So we're told to put on this armor to stand against that trickery of the devil. Verse 12, for we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. We're in a spiritual battle against powerful beings. So it is hard to stand. And Paul tells us here, put on this armor that we may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. But it's hard to stand. Even when we know who the enemy is, even when we know that he's at work, and we're given this spiritual armor to guard against him, it's still not easy. The world doesn't even know that they're fighting. Imagine that. Think about how hard it is for us individually, knowing what we know, and the world doesn't even know that it's fighting this spiritual battle. And Satan probably loves it that way, because he's not looking for a fair fight. He wants to influence from the shadows. He wants to lurk about so he can prey on those who are unexpecting. And he's good at it. Revelation chapter 12. Revelation chapter 12. Let's read verses 9 through 12. Read some more descriptions here of who Satan is and what he does, how he works. Revelation 12, beginning in verse 9. So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old, called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. Then I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, Now salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brethren, who accused them before our God day and night, has been cast down. And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb, and by the word of their testimony, and they did not love their lives to the death. Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you having great wrath, because he knows that he has a short time. We see a couple more descriptors here in this section. Verse 9 says, Satan, the devil, deceives the whole world. And what greater deception than to convince the world that he doesn't exist? In verse 10, he's called the accuser of the brethren. And we know really so little about what goes on in the spirit world. But while 6 out of 10 people who profess to be Christians are saying that Satan is not a literal being, this literal being is busy going before the throne of God, accusing the brethren, it says here. The elect, those who do know he exists. Probably doesn't have to spend as much time on those who don't even believe that he's real. Day and night, he accuses us. He's looking for any way possible to trip us up. And in his insanity, it seems like he's trying to cause God to come up with a reason to give up on us, as if God would do that. We know that he won't, as long as we stay in the fight. How can people not believe that Satan is real, that he's a literal being when they read passages like these? How can they not believe that he's real when they look around and see the way people treat each other in the world? How can they not believe he's real when they read Christ's own words about Satan? Let's turn back to John chapter 8 and read those. John chapter 8, beginning in verse 42, where Jesus Christ himself identifies the enemy. John 8, verse 42, Jesus said to them, If God were your Father, you would love me, for I proceeded forth and came from God, nor have I come of myself, but he sent me. Why do you not understand my speech? Because you're not able to listen to my word. Verse 44. You are of your father the devil, and the desires of your father you want to do. He was a murderer from the beginning, and does not stand in the truth, because there is no truth in him. When he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own resources, for he is a liar and the father of it. Jesus identifies Satan as the founder of sin, the originator of it. He says he was a murderer from the beginning. When you stop to think about that, it makes sense. Satan told Adam and Eve, you'll not surely die. if you disobey God, if you eat from this tree, you're not going to die. It's murder. By persuasion, tricking them into doing something that's going to cause their death. He also says here he's the liar. He's the father of lies. And when he interacted with Adam and Eve, when he said, "You shall not surely die," that was one of the lies. The big lie, really, was convincing them that they could decide what was right and what was wrong for themselves. Basically telling them they could be their own God. They could make decisions about these things on their own. And everything would be fine. But it goes back even further in time, really, when you stop and consider what Revelation 12 says. We didn't read this verse, but verse 4 of Revelation 12 talks about the serpent, the dragon, being cast to the earth. And it says he drew a third of the stars with his tail. Our understanding in the church is that's referring to him taking a third of the angels with him. A third of the angels, once righteous angels, that now serve him, serve Satan. What kind of lies did he have to tell? What kind of lies did he have to spin in order to convince angelic beings to follow him instead of the true God? It makes sense that he's the father of lies. And this phrase here, when Jesus Christ says that Satan speaks from his own, he speaks from his own resources. Barnes Notes says, he speaks from the things that belong to his nature. His speaking falsehood is originated by his own propensities or disposition. He utters the expressions of his genuine character. And when Satan lies, he's being true to his character. That's kind of an odd way to put it. When he lies, he's being true to his genuine character. He's showing what he's really like. He is the source of sin. He's the instigator of sin. He's the enemy of all righteousness, and he has to be identified so that people can understand this. It's who he is. It's what makes him who he is deep down. And sometimes people wonder if Satan could ever repent in the future. And God's a merciful God. Could this being, could Satan come to himself and realize, wow, I really need to repent and beg God for forgiveness? Let's turn back to Revelation chapter 20. Revelation chapter 20. Beginning verse 7 this time. Because this prophecy shows Satan's genuine character, what he's like and what he will always be like. Revelation 20, verse 7. Now when the 1,000 years have expired, Satan will be released from his prison. 1,000 years to stop and think about what he has done, how he's tried to thwart God's plan. And what happens? Verse 8. And he will go out to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, whose number is as the sand of the sea. They went up on the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city. And fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. So after 1,000 years in isolation to think about what he had done, 1,000 years of being bound and not being able to influence mankind, that sounds like an opportunity to repent to me. But immediately he's released, and he goes out to do what he does, to try to deceive. He's not going to change. Verse 10 says, the devil who deceived them was then cast into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet were. It's a better translation. And they, referring to Satan the devil and his demons, they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. Satan's not going to change. The rebellion of sin defines him, and that's not going to change no matter how much time he's given. And that's why he has to be held responsible for his influence, and he has to be removed. Although who Satan is, what he's like, seems so clear to us at this time, he still needs to be identified for much of the world. They can't yet see that his influence is causing so much trouble. And a couple of passages in the book of 2 Corinthians help us to see why he needs to be identified for the masses. We'll turn back to 2 Corinthians, chapter 4. And why can't people just see and believe that this being is at work? 2 Corinthians 4. We'll read verses 3 and 4. But even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing, whose minds the God of this age has blinded, who do not believe, lest the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine on them. And Paul's saying here that there are people who simply can't understand the gospel, the truth of God's plan, the truth of Jesus Christ, of the coming kingdom of God, and his reign as King of Kings. It's veiled. People's minds are blinded right now. But it says here in verse 4 that it's the God of this age who has blinded them. Satan has to be identified as the enemy working against mankind so that the blinders can be lifted. Their eyes will one day be opened like ours. The enemy has to be identified so that they can be given the opportunity to understand God's truth and be reconciled to him. But in chapter 11, we see another reason why Satan has to be identified for mankind. Why we can't just figure it out ourselves. Why so many people who even profess to be Christians don't believe these basic truths about who Satan is and what he's like. 2 Corinthians 11, beginning in verse 13, talking about false teachers. That's the context here. Verse 13 says, "For such are false apostles, deceitful workers, transforming themselves into apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for Satan himself transforms himself into an angel of light. Therefore, it is no great thing if his ministers also transform themselves into ministers of righteousness, whose end will be according to their works." Verse 14 right there tells us why the enemy has to be identified on this day, the Day of Atonement. Because he himself transforms himself into an angel of light. He knows how to portray himself as good. And without him being identified, without the minds of mankind being open to God's truth, to see what Satan is really like, they'll think he's good. Look at the world around us. What's considered good? Freedom of thought and expression, tolerance. You know, Satan's ways are even seen as love. Well, if you really love other people, you won't be so condemning of the decisions that they make, of their lifestyles, etc. Well, the book that I read says God is love. And Satan is the counterfeit. He tries to even take that title. He tries to even convince people that his way of doing things, of everyone deciding for themselves, is really the way of love. Because the minds of people are blinded right now. The fact that the Day of Atonement identifies the enemy is really built in to a special ceremony that was to take place on the Day of Atonement. The special ceremony described in Leviticus chapter 16. You can turn back there with me. You know, I've taken a lot of time so far just to talk about things you already know. Who Satan is, what he's trying to do, what he's like. That he needs to be identified not only for us but for all the world one day in order for them to really understand God's truth and accept it. And that is even built into this ceremony of the two goats in Leviticus chapter 16. Leviticus 16, let's begin in verse 1. It says, "Now the Lord spoke to Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron, when they offered profane fire before the Lord and died. And the Lord said to Moses, 'Tell Aaron your brother not to come at just any time into the holy place inside the veil, before the mercy seat which is on the ark, lest he die. For I will appear in the cloud above the mercy seat.'" So once a year, only during this ceremony, was the high priest allowed to enter the Holy of Holies, symbolic of the very throne room of God. There's so many other things we could talk about today that we won't get into detail on, but how amazing is it that we can approach the Holy of Holies anytime we want through prayer? Because of the blood of our sin offering, because of Jesus Christ, his death in our place, we don't have to wait for one time of year to enter the Holy of Holies. We enter it, in a sense, every time we get on our knees and pray to God. Verse 3, thus Aaron shall come into the holy place with the blood of a young bull as a sin offering and of a ram as a burnt offering. He shall put the holy tunic, the holy linen tunic and the linen trousers on his body. He shall be girded with a linen sash, and with a linen turban he shall be attired. These are holy garments. Therefore he shall wash his body in water and put them on. And he shall take from the congregation of the children of Israel 2 kids of the goats as a sin offering, and 1 ram as a burnt offering. Aaron shall offer the bull as a sin offering, which is for himself, and make atonement for himself and for his house. He shall take the 2 goats and present them before the Lord at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. Verse 8, then Aaron shall cast lots for the 2 goats, 1 lot for the Lord and the other lot for the scapegoat. We'll come back to that word. Verse 9, and Aaron shall bring the goat on which the Lord's lot fell and offer it as a sin offering. But the goat on which the lot fell to be the scapegoat shall be presented alive before the Lord to make atonement upon it and to let it go as a scapegoat into the wilderness. The Life, Hope, and Truth article on Leviticus 16 and the Day of Atonement. I'm going to read a short quote from this. It says, it should be noted that the live goat is referred to as a scapegoat in Leviticus 16, verse 8 and 10, in both the King James Version and the New King James Version of the Bible. This is not the best translation of the Hebrew word azazel, which is more accurately translated as goat of departure. Many Bible translations, including the American Standard Version, simply use the Hebrew word azazel with no attempt to translate it into English. The contemporary English version translates it as demon azazel. Other translations, such as the modern King James Version, render it complete removal. I think these are helpful. If your Bible has the word scapegoat in there, it's helpful to think of some of these other translations, goat of departure or complete removal. It's certainly helpful with what we know this goat pictures. Some scholars believe Azazel is the name of a demon inhabiting the wilderness. This would certainly describe Satan, the one whom the live goat Azazel represents. So as we go through this chapter, we're just going to highlight a couple of sections of it, but we'll see that there are these 2 goats serving 2 very different purposes, and we'll take special note of how they're differentiated between. Let's drop down to verse 15. It says, then he shall kill the goat of the sin offering, which is for the people. Bring its blood inside the veil, do with that blood as he did with the blood of the bull, and sprinkle it on the mercy seat and before the mercy seat. So he shall make atonement for the holy place because of the uncleanness of the children of Israel and because of their transgressions, for all their sins. And so he shall do for the tabernacle of meeting, which remains among them in the midst of their uncleanness. There shall be no man in the tabernacle of meeting when he goes in to make atonement in the holy place until he comes out, that he may make atonement for himself, for his household, and for the assembly of Israel. And he shall go out to the altar that is before the Lord and make atonement for it, and shall take some of the blood of the bull and some of the blood of the goat and put it on the horns of the altar all around. Then he shall sprinkle some of the blood on it with his finger 7 times, cleanse it and consecrate it from the uncleanness of the children of Israel. So this first goat, the goat that is killed, the purpose of this goat is to serve as a sin offering. And as we're reviewing the meaning of this day, many of you are very familiar with these concepts, but this goat that is killed, this sin offering, pictures Jesus Christ. Now on this day, when this day is fulfilled, in the Day of Atonement, the meaning wrapped up in it is fulfilled, the sin offering will be available to all mankind. Everyone who has ever lived will have the opportunity to accept the sacrifice of Christ for their sins. The wages of sin is death. All have sinned. Everyone needs this death penalty to be paid. We either pay for it ourselves, and that's it, we're done, to never live again, or we accept the sacrifice of Jesus Christ in our place, this first goat. If you drop down to verse 20, continue in verse 20, and when he has made an end for atoning, end of atoning for the holy place, the tabernacle of meeting and the altar, he shall bring the live goat. So now we have the second goat. Verse 21, Aaron shall lay both his hands on the head of the live goat, confess over it all the iniquities of the children of Israel and all their transgressions concerning all their sins, putting them on the head of the goat, and shall send it away into the wilderness by the hand of a suitable man. The goat shall bear on itself all their iniquities to an uninhabited land, and he shall release the goat into the wilderness. So here the live goat, representing Satan the devil, all of the sins of the people were to be placed on the head of this goat. The high priest is supposed to confess the sins of the nation on this goat. That the blame, the cause of sin, could be placed on this animal and sent away. But we know God wasn't only interested in goats and bulls and lambs. These were all symbolic of deeper spiritual things. This goat, the goat that is left alive, represents Satan the devil, the cause of sin, the enemy. And he'll have the blame for sin. He'll have the responsibility as the originator of sin and the instigator of it placed on his head. And he'll be sent away. As we read in Revelation 20, he'll be sent into the bottomless pit to be bound for 1,000 years and ultimately to be cast into the lake of fire. But really, what I want to focus on is in verse 8. If you go all the way back to verse 8, you know, what have we been talking about today? We've been talking about the fact that some people don't even believe that Satan is real. We've been talking about what he does. He deceives. He accuses the brethren. He blinds the minds of people. He tries to influence and get us to follow his pattern, his way of thinking. And we talked about how he needs to be identified because he presents himself as an angel of light. Well, even that is wrapped up in this ceremony in verse 8, where it says, Aaron shall cast lots for the two goats, one lot for the Lord, the other lot for the Azazel. Now, lots were cast for uncertain matters, matters in which God's will needed to be determined. God had to be the one to make the distinction between which of these goats was to represent Christ and which was to represent Satan. And I think there's a connection there with what we're talking about today. They needed God to show them which one was to represent Christ and which one was to represent Satan, because they couldn't figure it out for themselves. Both goats look the same. Now, God could have easily said a goat and a lamb. A goat and a horrendous looking rodent like this giant possum that went across our backyard last night right before sunset. Something obvious. Okay, this is the evil one. This is the clean animal. But he didn't. It's two goats, identical. And lots had to be cast so it could be determined which one was to represent Christ and which one was to represent Satan. And the same is true for us. The same is true for mankind. We can't figure it out on our own. We need God to identify the enemy. We need God to identify the Savior if we're going to be really reconciled with him, if we're going to be at one with him and dwell in his family forever. Without God's calling, we would not be able to distinguish between Satan and Jesus Christ, because he presents himself as this angel of light and deceives. If we think we can figure it out on our own and recognize him for ourselves, we're mistaken. Our eyes were blinded too until God lifted the veil from our minds. So wrapped up in this ceremony commanded by God thousands of years ago is this truth that God has to identify the being responsible for sin, and he will. And in doing so, he'll also make the being that served as a sin offering known to the masses so that they too can have their sins atoned for. Atonement for sin through the sacrifice of Christ will be made available to all mankind, symbolized in this day, these two goats. And it says that this ceremony, if you read in verse 29, it says that all of these things, this ceremony with these two goats, one goat to be sacrificed, the other goat to have the sins placed on its head and to be sent out away from the people, all of this took place on what day? Verse 29. This shall be a statute forever for you. In the seventh month, on the tenth day of the month, you shall afflict your souls and do no work at all, whether a native of your own country or a stranger who dwells among you. This was the ceremony on the Day of Atonement. So the cause of sin and death shall be made plain. The father and perpetuator of sin will be revealed, and he'll be dealt with. But you know, in verse 29 there, it mentions another aspect of this day that we're all familiar with, because by now, with only about 4.5 hours left until sunset, you're feeling it. It says that part of this day, part of the command, is that we're supposed to afflict our souls. As we're bringing this to a close, with everything we've talked about in our minds, why do we have to fast on this day? Why not have a celebration? The fact that all the world is going to be freed from Satan's influence and finally have the opportunity to accept the sacrifice of Jesus Christ for their sins. Why not rejoice on this day with abundance, with blessings, with a feast? Turn back to Leviticus chapter 23. Because we just want to make sure that this is clear. I kind of went in reverse order today. Typically we start with Leviticus 23 and say, hey, this is the day that we're commanded to keep. Kind of working backwards here today. But if you notice verse 26 of Leviticus 23, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, also the tenth day of the seventh month shall be the Day of Atonement. It shall be a holy convocation for you. You shall afflict your souls and offer an offering made by fire to the Lord. And you shall do no work on that same day, for it is the Day of Atonement, to make atonement for you before the Lord your God. For any person who is not afflicted in soul on that same day shall be cut off from his people. And any person who does any work on that same day, that person I will destroy from among his people. You shall do no manner of work. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations and all your dwellings. It shall be to you a Sabbath of solemn rest, and you shall afflict your souls on the ninth day of the month at evening. From evening to evening, you shall celebrate your Sabbath. Now, three times in this short set of instructions about this holy day, we're reminded to afflict our souls. So it's not by accident. But why? When the Day of Atonement is fulfilled and Satan is bound, it'll be a time of rejoicing, won't it? But we already know there is a devil. We know his devices. We know that he's after us. He's after mankind. Why not celebrate the fact that he's going to be bound finally? Well, fasting has several different outcomes in our lives. But what's one of the most basic, simple outcomes from fasting, just on a physical level? It's already been mentioned a couple times here, in the opening prayer, in the sermonette. As you come close to the end of your fast, one simple physical outcome of fasting is that we realize we're weak. Unless you're like my grandmother. She always started fasting a day before the Day of Atonement, because she felt like when she fasted, she just didn't feel it enough. I didn't inherit her genes. I'm good with the 24 hours. But one simple outcome of fasting is this reminder that we're weak because we are still physical. We are weak beings. Fasting reminds us of our nature. And in light of everything we've been discussing today, it should also remind us of our susceptibility to Satan's influence. Yes, this will be a time of rejoicing in the future when Satan is finally bound. But we're not there yet. And built into this observance of the day is this reminder that we are still weak. We are still physical. We are still susceptible to this influence of the enemy. Each year when we rehearse this time when Satan's influence will be halted, we're also reminded that it's present and powerful now. Reminded that we're weak and that we must draw near to God, seek unity and reconciliation with Him, so that we can not only identify the instigator of sin in our minds, but so we can truly stand against Him. So we afflict our souls and remember that we are just dust. Dust that needs the constant nourishment and influence of a righteous being if we're ever going to become anything more than dust. So, brethren, this is a day that I'm sure Satan the devil hates. Although at this time the vast majority of people, even professing Christians, do not believe that Satan is a literal being, the day is coming when he won't be able to hide anymore. The enemy will be identified, and he will be dealt with. God will call him on the carpet for who and what he is, the father of lies, the originator of sin, the enemy lurking about, seeking whom he may devour. And one day, when the Day of Atonement is fulfilled, the world will know that these things are true, that Satan does exist. They'll know why they couldn't recognize him before, because he transformed himself into an angel of light and deceived the entire world. And they'll understand that God had to do the identifying by opening their eyes to the truth. When the Day of Atonement is fulfilled, people will no longer agree with this statement: Satan's not a literal being, but only a symbol of evil. They'll know who the enemy is, and they'll know that he will be dealt with. And we know this now. We've been given the opportunity to understand these things now, and that's something to rejoice about, even while we're fasting. We rejoice today for the world. We quietly rejoice as we rehearse the fact that the entire world will be freed from Satan's influence and have the chance to be reconciled to God. But we also afflict ourselves through fasting, but still quietly rejoicing. And this fasting, in part, is a reminder of our personal weakness and our need to be at one with God now, so that we don't succumb to the influence of the wicked one, because he's not yet given up on pursuing us. So we must identify his attacks, stand against him and his influence now by drawing ever closer to our God and King. The day is coming soon when the enemy will be identified, and when the words of verse 3 of hymn number 184 will be a reality. From out of heaven an angel shall come down, and by his hand all evil shall be bound. The cause of sin and death shall be made plain for all to know when Christ shall come again. Godspeed that day, brethren. The enemy will be identified and removed. I hope you all have a fantastic feast. We certainly are planning to do so. We'll be able to spend the Feast of Tabernacles with 20 family members, counting our family of five. And we have five of them with us already this week, so we're enjoying that. But I hope you have a really outstanding Feast of Tabernacles, that it's a time of encouragement, a time of learning, and that we appreciate this beautiful plan that God's revealed to us.